bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't gamble. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel Sportsbook. I am your host, Todd Furman, joined, as always, by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. Perfect time to remind all of you, our loyal listeners, FanDuel.com/BetTheBoard. Use the promo code BetTheBoard. Take advantage of all sorts of generous sign-up bonuses, $1,000 free bets, enhanced odds, same-game parlays, everything you could possibly imagine right there in the palm of your hands to get you set for a busy week of betting football, baseball, and anything else you feel you have an edge. And Payne, what'd you
think? NHL.
Yeah, NHL opening night, Tuesday. I know you're getting excited to watch your Penguins on the road against the defending Stanley Cup champions in the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Ooh, can't wait. What's going on with Crosby, by the way? I saw you return to practice a little bit earlier than expected. I doubt he's going to be out there this week.
No. They're saying they're going to take a slow and cautious approach for the wrist surgery he underwent. Originally, he was supposed to miss just a couple of games. We'll see exactly when he's out there. But the Pens, and I know you've called for a potential trade multiple times, they'll be without Evgeny Malkin for the first 2 months, it appears, as well. So we'll see if they can get off to a quick start without their second-line center.
What's the protocol there for a hockey wrist injury? Is that just you go to the Adam Banks method, you grab the stick and try to twirl it back and forth to find out if the wrist is strong enough to proceed in game action?
You make sure you have full dexterity in there, because I can tell you, for as talented as Sidney is, there'll be plenty of defensemen and forwards across the league that as soon as Sid picks up the puck for the first time, you give him a nice little slash right there on the wrist above the glove cuff, and you make sure you test everything out that he's not one shift and done. But I think your Penguins will be just fine, one of the tougher divisions in hockey, and that's about the extent of the NHL preview you'll get around these parts.
They were hoping for a win total best bet, Todd.
You know what? I might be able to offer one of those up, but I'll probably refrain. I do have to ask you, though, about what we saw unfold last night under the lights in Arrowhead. The biggest question, were you able to stay up and watch the game in its entirety with that hour halftime delay because of Mother Nature?
That was the worst thing ever. I was hoping that Buffalo came right out in the third quarter and scored, and I could have just went to bed at that point, but of course they didn't. It was a defensive battle suddenly in the second half with the weather and the long layoff. The offenses couldn't really regroup, so I ended up staying. I stayed up for, I think, the vast majority of it. I did kind of pack it in on the last Emmanuel Sanders touchdown, so I think that came with like 6-7 minutes to go in the game, and I went to bed at that point.
Gotcha. I mean, hey, you watch the way the game unfolds, a phantom holding call on Buffalo, a phantom roughing the passer. Thought for a second we were going to get a little bit of entertainment value out of that contest. But alas, Buffalo, a team that played with a chip on its shoulder, went out there, moved the football with relative ease through the air. And I have to ask, Payne, you know, we talked about Kansas City and a potential buy low spot. I think both of us kept ourselves on the sidelines smartly enough in that particular spot. But how nervous should we start to be about this Kansas City defense that really can't stop anybody and is giving up a historically bad 7.2 yards per play?
I'm not sure. It's really difficult to gauge. You know, when you're 2-3, everyone's got questions. Everyone thinks they've figured it out. Everyone is like nitpicking at what's wrong with you. And so this wasn't a defense that was built to be elite by design, right? It was a defense that was built to be good getting after the quarterback and playing with leads, and they're not playing with leads right now. And so those deficiencies are coming out. But like, who have they played? It's like this murderer's row.
Oh, schedule's been tough. I'm not going to say anything
and
to the contrary.
So it was never a defense. Like this defense at peak is an average defense. When you look at across the board, like when they made their Super Bowl run, I think they finished 14th in defensive efficiency. And that's all you need with the best offense in football. And maybe there's varying degrees of like, hey, we're going to be average, we're going to be slightly below average. Right now they're bad. They're playing great offenses. But you know, I watched last night's game, and I think we maybe had a little bit of a different viewpoint. Like, I thought Josh Allen was very good. Take nothing away. But Brian Daboll was a monster last night. And we said at the beginning of the breakdown on that side of the ball, it's like, I would bet that Josh Allen's going to use his legs a little bit more in this game. And that Dawson Knox would be a little bit of a matchup advantage. And both those things came true. Like, Josh Allen had 11 carries for 59 yards. He was Buffalo's leading rusher. And they were impactful carries, right? It was touchdowns. It was, you know, drive extenders on third down. You also had Dawson Knox, who was the leading receiver, almost 40 yards a catch. Now, guys were wide open. That was the one thing that was, like, staggering to me. Like, Josh Allen made a great throw on the first touchdown to Emmanuel Sanders. That was a seed. But you look at a lot of the other, like, chunk plays Buffalo gained last night, it was like a really good mix of offensive design and just horrific defense blowing assignments. Josh Allen actually had a completion percentage below expectation. And so getting back to your questions, like, Kansas City's defense is not great. It's not elite. It wasn't meant to be elite. It was meant to play with leads. It was meant to get after the quarterback, and it was meant to have a secondary that could cover a little bit. But you're looking right now at who they've played offensively. It's just an elite schedule of offenses. And it's tough to defend really good offenses when you're down your starting quarter in Chidavius Ward. You are down your best defensive lineman in Chris Jones, and you have two guys that are returning from extended layoffs in Frank Clark and Willie Gay. Both guys were on limited snap counts last night. So you're talking about four starters that did not play from a defense that's not good. And the result is what you got last night, and then tack on another four turnovers, which continue to bite the Kansas City Chiefs.
I want to ask you about the turnovers, because we talk all the time about a cyclical nature. We know in college football specifically that typically teams that have a bad turnover margin, they'll regress towards the mean in subsequent seasons. But I also tend to believe that turnovers are oftentimes not just entirely a product of bad luck, but also a lack of focus. How much of that do you think is bad luck for what Kansas City's gone through with a -9 turnover ratio the last three games versus drop balls and little things and attention to detail that we haven't seen from them during this impressive run over the last couple seasons?
I mean, it was a wet ball last night. We knew the rain was coming in. And so it's like, what do you do, right? Like, one's on a kickoff return. I mean, I don't know. It's helmet on ball. And then the other one is right out of the half, Buffalo scores a defensive touchdown on the crosser to Tyreek. It's like, it's right in his hands. It's a wet ball. I mean, I don't know. And then you have the perfect tipped pass. I mean, Gregory Rousseau, awesome play to tip it to himself, but it's like a sidearm throw that it looks like it's almost like tipped downwards, but shoots up and then Rousseau catches. So it's like another deflection. I don't know what the answer is, but certainly you're not going to expect the Kansas City Chiefs to continue to turning it over four times a game. That's just, I don't know how you rely on that if you're continuing to fade them. It doesn't seem like something that is going to continue moving forward, but clearly they're being frustrated a little bit. And that was the whole MO last night of what Buffalo did. They built the lead so the Chiefs defense couldn't execute at its peak. And they also built the lead so the Chiefs had to throw into the teeth of the defense, right? It's one thing if you're playing in a neutral state game and you want to play, and you're Sean McDermott, want to play light boxes, we're just going to hand it off and we're going to pick up 4, 5, 6 yards a chunk. But when you're behind two scores, all of a sudden the Chiefs have to pass the ball down the field and you get an explosive offense that gets frustrated having to take 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 yards a pop rather than these large chunk plays. And then Mahomes was off last night. I mean, that first drive, he misses a wide open Travis Kelce down the field that potentially, if thrown properly, is a touchdown. So you had a combination of a lot of things transpire last night, none of which were good for Kansas City, and give Buffalo all the credit in the world. That was their Super Bowl. They were the more focused team. They were the better prepared team. They executed better. They were tougher. I mean, you look at some of the tackles defensively, like, they were giving Kansas City the business right after the play a little bit, but just more physical. They wanted that game far more. They understood what it meant getting over that hurdle, and hopefully they're going to be hosting playoff games in a rowdy stadium, and that's going to be enough to get them over the top to make a Super Bowl push this year.
And of course, we'll get Buffalo in prime time again next week on Monday night, where they'll have a chance to avenge a regular season loss last year against the Tennessee Titans. So clearly a game will break down a week from today and see if Buffalo can keep some of that momentum going forward. Other than that, Payne, as far as the good, the bad, and the ugly was concerned for NFL Week 5, what did you see in the good variety, things that really stood out to you?
I think you have to go back to Justin Herbert. It is becoming... If you're starting an organization right now, and boy, I hate to even say this out loud.
I know where you're going with this before it gets there, I think.
I think he's the best quarterback in football right now. And I would be really interested to see what he would look like with Andy Reid calling his plays. Because it happened again against the Browns. And he just continues to bail the Chargers offense out. And if you look at some of the touchdown drives that the Chargers had yesterday, I mean, you go through this list right now. 3rd and 8 at the Cleveland 30. Picks it up, extends the drive, and it ends up in a touchdown. 3rd and 10 at their own 28. Mike Williams, 72-yard touchdown. And then trailing, you had a 4th and 7 at the Cleveland 22. No problem. Just find Keenan Allen. 1st down. Ends in 7. 3rd and 5 at the own 44. They're down, I believe, 6 at that point in the fourth quarter. They pick up a 1st down. 1 play later, touchdown. The very next drive, again, down 7. Justin Herbert picks up 3rd and 10, 4th and 4, and 4th and 8. And the Chargers score a touchdown again. 5 of the Chargers' scoring drives require Justin Herbert to be the magic man again, right? 3rd and long, 4th down. 5 of those drives required that to score touchdowns. It was another one of those games where if you look at 1st and 2nd down, Cleveland was plus 13 in net success rate. They were a net plus 3.4 yards per play better than the Chargers. Justin Herbert comes to the rescue. 3rd and 4th down, the Chargers plus 23% net success rate and 8.5 yards per play better on those two downs, the non-predictive downs. And so I think Justin Herbert was probably the best thing I saw in NFL Week 5, Todd.
That's strong praise from a man who we know has been in the Patrick Mahomes camp, so it says an awful lot. I do wonder what kind of magic fairy dust Justin Herbert has working in his favor as well, because I think you and I were actually the closest defender to Mike Williams on his 2 touchdown passes in those games. Now, of course, there's obviously a lot that goes into getting him that wide open, but I'm still not sure exactly what Cleveland was doing in coverage. I did find it interesting in relation to Justin Herbert watching Drew Brees. I can't remember if it was the pregame show for Football Night in America or if it was at halftime when they were trying to fill, and Drew Brees talking about Justin Herbert and how the ball just looks so much different coming out of his hand. And coming from a guy who's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, one who's accomplished a ton, given the relationship he has with the Chargers offensive coordinator, Brees basically gushing about Herbert's ability was pretty telling for me.
I think we kind of all knew the ability. We weren't sure, based upon what they did at Oregon with him, if there were some other issues. But you always saw the size, the stature, that he could move, and that he had a rocket arm. And so... Not the best if you're a Miami Dolphins fan right now. Not the best. Chris Greer butchered that one along with a couple other early round picks, and the Dolphins are 1-4 and the Chargers are 4-1. And so now it's up to going and getting a new quarterback potentially in Deshaun Watson. We'll see if that move happens before the trade deadline.
I'm just glad, Payne, that the man responsible for holding Justin Herbert back in college is UNLV's head football coach here, Marcus Arroyo. So that's all I'm thrilled about, knowing exactly what it takes to keep that howitzer of an arm in check in a college offense and never realizing its full potential. Do we give?
I think it's also the head coach, right? He likes the big old uglies up front, and he recruits offensive linemen very well. So got to be able to establish the run a little bit too.
Yeah, we know that's the most efficient way to move the football in 2021, especially at the college game, where nothing says methodical and efficient than going 14 plays trying to pick up 5 yards in a cloud of dust for any program not named Army, Air Force, or Navy. Do we give the Steelers full marks for what they were able to do on offense? More than 50% in terms of conversions on 3rd downs. You see them get to nearly 400 yards of total offense. Najee Harris finally gave them a little bit of spark in a true ground game, albeit losing Juju Smith-Schuster for the season with a shoulder injury. Or was that more a reflection of Denver's defensive deficiencies at Heinz Field yesterday?
I was a little surprised with how poor Denver played defensively. I know a couple guys are obviously banged up on that side of the ball, but not the best from Fangio. But that was awesome from Pittsburgh, kind of seeing some life. That was far and away their best offensive performance of the season. There were some, I would call it efficient running, and that was probably the best way to label that. I know only 46% of their carries graded successful, but that was a huge leap up for them. Mike Tomlin called out the O-line this week, and the guys up front responded. Big Ben said in his post-game presser as much that the O-line played very well. Najee Harris was awesome, and I think he's been awesome all season. It's just been very restrictive in terms of the O-line play in front of him, and then basically he's become a check down running back, not necessarily bad if you're in a PPR league. But yesterday, 70% of Najee Harris's rushes were successful. He had three explosives, 5.3 a carry. And then because Denver actually had to respect the run, Big Ben was able to throw into windows with less defenders. And I thought Big Ben was decent, didn't have a single turnover worthy throw, and the offensive line kept them clean. 54% passing success rate. He had four explosive passes himself. Again, Denver's defense is a little banged up, but when you factor in the opponent, I thought it was the Steelers' best offensive performance of the entire season.
You know, it's pretty interesting when you look at teams, especially through the first couple weeks of the season, and how they can get a break here or a break there to really change their season outlook. And I think the Steelers kind of fall into that bucket. They obviously had a held on for dear life. Teddy Bridgewater drives Denver down the field for the potential game-tying score, and you get the goal line stand. But now suddenly the game on Sunday Night Football for the Steelers, you don't have to face Russell Wilson in your own building. You get Geno Smith in his starting debut. If you're able to win that game, you get to 500. You have a massive revenge game for last year's playoff loss on the road at Cleveland. Then you get a little bit of a breather with home games against the Bears and Lions. With a break or two, suddenly the Steelers are very much in the thick of things as far as the NFC North. Team that a lot of us wanted to write off for dead, given some of the trials and tribulations we'd seen along that offensive line.
Yeah, it's not a good football team.
No, I'm not going to sugarcoat it by any
stretch.
To,
yeah, I mean, they have the ability to linger with, you know, going 500 or around that area, right? Like one game below, one game over. I just think that's probably what they are. And, you know, Mike Tomlin, for all his deficiencies and decision-making and, you know, managing a clock and when to go for it on fourth down, he does seem to have a team that's always bought into him, and for the most part very motivational unless they are a large favorite. But I think they have an ability to kind of flirt with that win total that basically closed 8.2. And so it was one of those ones, Todd, where I know both you and I debated. We wanted to go under on the Steelers,
yep,
but the market was very fair in that 8.2 closing assessment. And it's just like, that's just kind of what they might be this year. And you're right. They're going to catch breaks as this schedule kind of lays out. Now you get the big win in a coin flip game against Denver, although they did close a small dog there once Teddy was upgraded. But now, again, on Sunday Night Football, you get a Seattle team that's struggling a little bit right now on both sides of the ball, and they're going to be without Russell Wilson, who we believe has basically propped that organization up. And this will be a very good test for what Seattle might be and what they might look like a year from now without Russell Wilson.
It's a very good point. We've obviously seen the market correct itself quite a bit, and we'll get to some of the adjustments, injury-wise or other, and look ahead lines in just a few moments. With the good pain, there obviously comes the bad, and we had a laundry list of coaching candidates to try and make this list. I'm not sure if I should take shots at the low-hanging fruit in David Culley, who once again elects to kick a field goal from what felt like 72 yards, which ultimately swung the momentum there in a game that the Texans were pretty good and buttoned up for at least 2.5 quarters, end up coming up on the wrong side of a 25-22 decision. Zach Taylor electing to run the football with a franchise quarterback on 3rd and 5, because as we know in the NFL in 2021, when you have a chance to kick a 50-plus yard field goal to win a game, you can't pass up on that opportunity. Or Kyle Shanahan, and a guy that we've praised early and often around this very podcast with some questionable coaching decisions, knowing he had a first-time starter in Trey Lance out there.
Yeah, let's start with Cully. That is some really low-hanging fruit. I didn't watch the game, but I did see the play-by-play, and my guess is up seven, you didn't like the field goal attempt from 55?
No, I did not. Not with the NFL rules, knowing that if you missed a field goal, you basically put the Patriots two plays away from getting into scoring range themselves.
So, again, I saw the play-by-play, and I don't necessarily hate anything Houston did there. I mean, first down, they called a trick play. Effectively, it was a direct snap to the running back, and then I believe they threw on second and third down unsuccessfully. I think the win probability bot actually agrees with field goal there to make it two scores. It's a 55-yarder indoors. It's not like we're asking him to do something out of the norm. What would you have done there? You would have punted?
You know, honestly, I'm not quite sure. When I went back, watched it, and, you know, knowing it was fourth and short, Mills had been playing with some confidence, and you'd like to see when you're a more than a touchdown underdog and you have the momentum, you're playing on the front foot. My initial inclination, and I didn't have the charts in front of me, would have been to go for it there. And obviously, hindsight's always 20-20. I'm just not necessarily a big proponent of that kind of field goal unless you have a guy like Justin Tucker that you know is going to head at a pretty high clip.
Right. And that's just kind of David Culley's nature. Already we're seeing articles this morning about who his replacement will be and how he's cost the team multiple games. The decision making for this kind of stuff in the late games, like, has just not gone well for him. And we didn't think it would. We saw the presser to start the season where he couldn't even say the word analytics, and he basically said everything's going to be about feel and my vibe for the game. And we saw it against the Carolina Panthers, where I believe Houston was down three and had a like fourth and four, I want to say, from the Carolina 39. Didn't kick a field goal, didn't go for it, punted. And the next drive, his team's down two scores. And so this really has been something where David Culley's continued to struggle. Even something that didn't get a lot of attention started to, because these decision-making gaffes are starting to pile up. But you go back to the Cleveland Browns game, where there was a situation, I believe it was in the first half, third and 15 for the Houston Texans. They go out, Cooks picks up 14 yards, and there's a penalty on the Browns. And so David Culley has the choice to accept the penalty and have a third and 10 where you can potentially pick up the first down, or you decline the penalty and go for it on fourth and one from midfield. And David Culley declined the penalty to make it fourth and one and then punted. And that probably was one of the largest head scratchers you've ever seen. And all of a sudden they panned to Kevin Stefanski, and he mutters something to the effect of, "What in the world?" And that's basically David Culley in a nutshell right now. He's got no idea what he's doing in terms of when to go for it, when to kick, when to, you know, take a 55-yard field goal, when to punt it. He's just struggling with that type of decision-making. And so ultimately, he's probably going to be a one-and-done type head coach.
Yep, makes a ton of sense. I mean, not quite the coaching pedigree. You love to see a guy get a chance, but sometimes you have to surround yourself with smart people and those that are going to try and help you with making proper decisions in those kind of spots. I mean, Zach Taylor, hey, the Bengals should have won that game. Not quite sure what went on there. And then, like we talked about, it feels like you cry over spilled milk when you have a side in the 49ers, but I think we both expected more from Kyle Shanahan in that spot.
Yes, let's go with Kyle Kyle Shanahan, and then we can kind of gravitate towards the end game situation there of Zach Taylor, because that might be a little bit quicker. I looked at, you know, I watched every snap of the San Francisco game, and there were, I believe, six teams that outgained their opponents and lost yesterday. It was, you know, a lot of sloppy football, a lot of variance going on. Now, it made for great TV watching, right? There's a lot of games that came down to the end. And so for the fan, it was fantastic. But unfortunately for us and the listeners, San Francisco is one of the six teams that outgained their opponent and lost, and they didn't cover as well. But the 49ers outgained Arizona by 0.7 yards per play. When you think about taking six in a game where the total points scored were 27, I'm probably liking that play even better if you just kind of told me that out loud. I feel terrible for the 49er defensive players. They were lights out yesterday. Kyler Murray, 240 total yards. But this game was on Kyle Shanahan. And you remove the two scoring drives. San Francisco had six other trips to Arizona territory, and they came away with 0 points on those six trips. They drove to the Arizona 48 twice, the Arizona 45, the 34, the 32, and the one-yard line, and came away with nothing. Only two drives all day didn't enter Arizona territory. And I hate to be play call guy. I typically cringe when other people talk about play calling. But Kyle Shanahan was terrible. And that's something I was never worried about with Kyle Shanahan. But you just kind of look at some of the play calling, some of the design, some of the things he was doing for Trey Lance. Only 28% of Trey Lance dropbacks featured play action. Lance just lived in shotgun. You had this very aggressive defense, and yet you only threw two screens all game, and those were the highest rated throws Trey Lance had. You kind of dig back into some of the play calling stuff, and just like, you know, not a single throwback. Nothing to negate the aggressive defensive mentality that Arizona had. Even some of the situations where you're in like go for it mode, right? Like four down mode, when you trailed by three late with 7 minutes to go, call plays that say, hey, we're going for this on four downs. Instead, first down onward basically suggested that we're going to put this ball in Trey Lance's hands and make him Peyton Manning from the pocket rather than using his best attribute right now. I mean, first down on that series where they bust out on fourth and four, it's a drop back pass, one read to the sideline, and it gets tipped. But there's just like, you got to have other elements to the offense. You got to make the defense defend multiple things. It just wasn't. And then finally on second down during that little series, it's a handoff to Trey Lance, who picks up 6 yards on second down. That should be the first down play call. And then again on third and four and fourth and four, it's like no element of Trey Lance's legs anywhere. We're just going to make him a drop back passer in the pocket. We're going to have him go through his reads and his progressions. Just nothing to help him out. And that was very weird to me. There wasn't any disguise. There wasn't any creativity. I mean, even the series where you have first and five or first and goal from the five. First down, you run Trey Lance. Now you have second and goal from the one, and you can't pick up 1 yard on three downs. It was just terrible. And you also had the fourth and one, where you try to get like tricky and put Kyle Juszczyk under center to pick it up. Like, again, I that's great. Be creative there. It just makes no sense. If you're going to have a guy who's 6'2", 240, run the ball 1 yard from under center, I don't want it to be my fullback who's no threat to throw the ball. I want it to be my quarterback who's 6'2", 240 with a threat to throw the ball. It was terrible from Kyle Shanahan yesterday. And even despite that horrific offensive performance, you're still sitting there with the ball at midfield, 7 minutes to go in the fourth quarter in a 10-7 game, catching six. I felt pretty good at that point.
Yep, I was right there with you. One thing that you texted me during the game and pointed out that I didn't notice, I couldn't quite put my finger on it, so you helped me articulate some of my thoughts there. Trey Lance, when you get so accustomed to watching players that are as quick and dynamic in space when they have the ball in their hands, like a Kyler Murray or Lamar Jackson, you watch Trey Lance, and I think the best word I can use to describe his running ability is lumbering. He looks more like a fullback out there that's got to drop his shoulder than someone who's elusive and going to make guys miss in the hole. I guess it's a little difference when you're taking on NFL caliber defenders instead of going up against Missouri Valley Football Conference opponents.
He can run. Let's not sugarcoat that. And when he like gets moving forward, he's a long strider and he's certainly fast. But you're right, he doesn't have like the quickness of Kyler. He doesn't have the ability to get to the top end speed like Kyler. And you saw in that fourth and goal from the one, again, 6'2", 240 pounds. If we're going to run him, let it be a QB sneak, right? Let it be something where maybe we are in shotgun and we go to Trent Williams' side with a tight end next to Trent Williams and a fullback in front leading the way. And that's what they did to pick up 4 yards on first down. But instead, we basically had him line up under center and he rolled out. And I understand the run pass option that provides. And he probably could have done a better job rather than taking on contact, diving towards the invisible pylon there. Like, you have the pylon, but it's basically the invisible end line and just extending. But yeah, you're not going to outrun the likes of Isaiah and Zavian Collins and Buda Baker. Like, he's not that type of fast. So that was interesting. And, you know, just again, it comes down to Kyle Shanahan, one of the best offensive minds the game has, one of the better play callers the game has. Wasn't the best yesterday. And unfortunately, that was our undoing. And the 49ers defense was just fantastic. I mean, just made big stops all day, really bottled in that offense. And it was kind of what we expected, right? Like, this is just a very weird offense. It's really freaking good. It really is. And the offensive line is improved and Kyler's improved and you have weapons all over the place. But again, I just come back to it's like it's a lot of backyard football. And sometimes you lose that consistency. And we had like a good spot to kind of fade that offense. And that part of the handicap was perfect. And I thought the game, again, I would bet it again tomorrow if we knew that that was going to be how it played out late. Like, give me plus six in a game where we're at midfield with the ball 7 minutes to go in the fourth quarter down three. I'm all about that life.
Yep.
And no, so
not going to disagree with that.
It wasn't great. Yeah, it wasn't great from Kyle Shanahan.
Zach Taylor, real quick, end game situations. You have Joe Burrow, one of the best quarterbacks in the league, and third and five, you decide to run. I'm thinking, watching the game, going, oh, this is four down territory. I understand why you run the draw there. Then you bring out the field goal kicker. You have a chance to knock off the Green Bay Packers. You better knock out one of the Giants when that opportunity is given to you. In my opinion, you can't play conservatively.
My thing there is I actually don't agree with the run play, and I think that was the issue with it.
Well, I think if it's four down territory, go for it and run it. But if you're going to, your decision's going to be if we get to fourth and one, in my opinion, you have to know what you're going to do in that spot before you even run the play on third down.
Again, my issue there is, right, like you're looking at how you construct an offense and you're sitting at third and five from the Green Bay 42. And it never crosses Zach Taylor's mind that what I'm doing here on third and five from the Green Bay 42 is handing it off to a second string running back. And we discussed this second string running back, P. Ryan, on the podcast in our breakdown. It was like he's 9% below an average running back last year in terms of success rate. So that's what Zach Taylor chose to do, is hand it off to a backup running back instead of saying, you know what? We drafted a quarterback number one overall. Our best position group on the entire team is our receiving group. And we're going against a defense that plays a soft shell coverage and is without the best cover cornerback potentially in the league. And we're just going to hand it off to a second round running back. It makes no sense. Now, his kicker, I believe they drafted him in the fifth round out of Florida. I know he's got a monster leg. And that's the one thing. It's like, I won't debate how, like, a coach knows the distance of his kicker's leg. He sees him every day at practice, and the distance was not an issue. But just, like, kind of the mindset, right? Like, it's like, we're going to hand it off to a second round, or a second string running back, so that our rookie kicker can attempt a pressure-packed kick and give Matt LaFleur credit.
Yep.
Right? He called timeout.
Smart. Smart, smart play.
So there's smart play. That's what every coach in that situation should do. Make the opponent do something. Make them make a decision. And then make sure there's repercussions if that decision is not correct or it fails. And so by Matt LaFleur calling a timeout there, it said, hey, you want to attempt this 57-yarder? Awesome. You miss it, we're going to have great field position, and I got one of the best quarterbacks in the world to go down in there and let us attempt one of our field goals. And so that was awesome by Matt LaFleur doing that, very smart. But I don't mind the field goal attempt. I am just so dead set against the call on third down. It was just terrible to me. You got it. I mean, teams are dying for franchise quarterbacks. And I don't know if Joe Burrow is going to be elite, but you, as an organization, drafted him number one. You believe he's your franchise quarterback. You can't turn around and hand it off to a backup running back and not let your franchise quarterback throw the ball against a depleted secondary and when you have three great receivers. That was the problem with that in my mind.
Such a weird game in a variety of fashions, with Mason Crosby, one of the league's most accurate kickers, missing a number of field goals. Green Bay, of course, playing for the win a couple of times. And then Joe Burrow, his first pass in overtime. Again, I won't claim to know exactly what that route tree is supposed to look like, if Tyler Boyd's supposed to sit down in the slot. But when you watch in real time, not exactly an ideal setup, but the Bengals were given a stay of execution. They just weren't able to capitalize and end up emerging from that game with a 3-point loss, ironically enough falling right in the middle of a game that opened Green Bay minus 3.5, closed Green Bay minus 2, and set bookmakers running for the hills as the general public came in hand over fist at a cheaper price while the professionals were able to cash with the best of the number. Last thing, I mean, I mentioned field goals, so that was kind of what I had marked down for the ugly. Did want to get your take real quick on the bad. The Minnesota Vikings, I can't figure this team out for the life of me. And of course, our listeners know we have a vested interest in their win total. You look at this team at 2-3, expect them to be better. A game that they dominated for 3.5 quarters against the Lions, they need an improbable 50-plus yard field goal in their own right to get out of there with a 19-17 victory after an Alexander Mattison fumble. But this game should have never been that close if it wasn't for the Vikings' ineptitude when it came to moving the football and stumbling around in the green zone all afternoon.
They can't seem to play a good game where every single part of the team operates in unison at the same time. You're either going to get a great offensive performance and the defense is dog shit. You're going to get a decent defensive performance and the offense can't execute. I mean, the first 6 trips to the red zone for Minnesota, or just outside the red zone, 1 touchdown. That was it. The 5 other trips ended in 3 field goals, a turnover, and a missed field goal. The Vikings were just epically bad in the money area. And awesome. The Lions competed. They had a chance to win that game late. Minnesota should have been up 3 freaking scores early in that game. And that shouldn't even been close. And that's what happens when you turn the ball over and you settle for 3. You don't put opponents away. And so all of a sudden, you see a Detroit team fighting for their first win, gaining confidence throughout, as that continues to be a 1-score type game. And then just again, your kicker. No problem banging home a game winner with pressure from further away. You had a chance to go up 13 late with, what was it, under 5 minutes to go for sure. And he just pops the ball up and somehow he's short on a 48-yarder. Just, it's very weird right now in Minnesota. Let's just put it that way. A lot of weird things going on there. Now, I don't think they're dead and buried. I don't think that win total's done. We've seen slow starts from Minnesota last year, and they kind of regrouped and regathered with a team that I think had less talent last year. So they're not done by any stretch. Huge game here against Carolina coming up. That feels like a must win for both teams. So it doesn't really shock me that we've seen under money come in at 47.5 this morning down to 46, but must win game for both those teams. And I don't think Minnesota's dead and buried yet. They just need to kind of play a little bit more consistently in every facet of the game.
Yeah, you talk about consistency. This is clearly a stretch of Minnesota's schedule that's going to define their outlook, not only for the win total, but if this team is going to get into the thick of things in terms of punching a ticket to the postseason. At the Panthers, home against the Cowboys in prime time, which we know will be an absolutely electric environment at US Bank Stadium on Sunday Night Football. At the Ravens, at the Chargers, home against Green Bay. I know people think I'm nuts, and my disdain to a certain extent is well documented for Green Bay overachieving, given some of their pieces and their metrics, but I'll make the case that Minnesota right now is a better football team, but we just haven't seen it in all facets of the game showing up on a single Sunday. So it'll be interesting to see if it can happen as early as this week against the Carolina team that could potentially get their primary weapon and Christian McCaffrey back from that hamstring injury. Anything else before we transition into a couple of look-ahead lines and get into the Monday Night Football game between the Colts and Ravens that you wanted to make note of for NFL Week 5?
No, I think that's it. Let's get to the look-ahead lines and then the Monday night breakdown. Maybe get out of here in under an hour.
All right, real quick on the look-ahead lines, I'll rattle them off. If you have a comment or two, feel free to chime in. These are all courtesy of FanDuel Sportsbook. And want to again remind all of you, our loyal listeners, all these look-ahead lines are available in our Friday Market Moves column that we publish on the Bet the Board website. Got a text from a couple of buddies. Payne goes, man, we had no idea you guys were doing written content this season. I'm going, well, that's why we try and share some of the information on social media. And our writer was dead on talking about where the money would come in on the Raiders-Bears game with Chicago winning outright. So encourage you guys to check all that stuff out. Some great written content to supplement your handy capping, usually an article a day or 3 to 4 pieces a week, especially during football season. Rams, we're seeing them as a double-digit favorite against the New York Giants. Look-ahead number here had the Rams right around a touchdown. Of course, a big reason for this adjustment, Saquon Barkley appears poised to miss some time with yet another lower body injury, and Daniel Jones, who was foaming at the mouth after his head bounced off the turf against the Dallas Cowboys, potentially a long shot to be under center, which means Mike Glennon could be the guy for Big Blue.
Daddy Longneck under center. Giants were plus 7, I believe, on the look ahead, so we're out to 10.5, and you hit that basically out of the park in terms of why there's been the adjustment. Daniel Jones, they said after the game that he was in the locker room talking to his friends and family and teammates and everything seemed fine. Boy, he had to get helped off the field. He came up after that hit. His face was pale. He was foaming at the mouth. And so that might be an interesting one to see if he can return in time. Saquon's ankle injury, they'll do an MRI on that. Fortunately, it looked like there was a ton of swelling, so it might just be an ankle sprain. But it sounds like he's going to be out not just this week, but maybe a couple weeks. And then you also have the big question marks of, do the other receivers return, right? Is Sterling Shepard back? Is Slayton back? You also have the Rams with extended time having played Thursday night. So that's the reason for this adjustment on the price at this point.
One other injury, too, that we didn't even mention that I saw early this morning. I didn't realize Kenny Golladay hurt as well with a hyperextended knee. So if the Giants aren't able to get the two receivers back with a hamstring and no Golladay, suddenly Kadarius Toney becomes your primary weapon in the passing game with Mike Glennon throwing. Not the recipe for success against a Los Angeles Rams team who, as you mentioned, will have extra time to prepare. Denver Broncos, look ahead number here as they'll welcome in the Las Vegas Raiders. That game was 2.5 at FanDuel Sportsbook. Number out to 3 last evening, trending closer to 3.5. And even seeing some 3.5s pop in up in the desert, suddenly this game, two very desperate teams sitting at 3-2 with their seasons kind of teetering on the brink.
That's what it feels like, a must-win division game for both. Denver found some life late, and so whatever transpired early in that game, Teddy didn't quite look like himself early, but kind of regrouped the troops, and they were able to move the ball. I think what we're seeing now is the Raiders come back to life a little bit. Derek Carr is getting antsy in the pocket, not really trusting the offensive line, and for good reason. It's a makeshift offensive line with a guy playing center that isn't a center, and your guard situation is really crap at this point, and you know, you moved Alex Leatherwood inside because you didn't trust him at tackle, and so teams are getting pressure on the Raiders. And now there's film after 3 or 4 weeks on what this version of the Raiders are doing, and basically they have one weapon in Darren Waller. You just aren't getting consistent play outside from Ruggs and Edwards. Both have like the wow moments, but we saw yesterday with Edwards a couple key drops, and so that's what we're seeing out of the offense. The defense has regressed a little bit, finally getting tested a little bit. There's some injuries in the secondary as well to Mullen. And I believe Casey Hayward was dinged up towards the end of last week, so I'll have to check the injury report on that. But again, it's a must-win game for Denver, must-win game for the Raiders. I'm not shocked to see this move. And again, it reopened 3, and now we're seeing first thing this morning out to 3.5. So huge game within that division for both teams.
Cross-conference showdown at Foxborough. This is the biggest adjustment as far as look-aheads are concerned. New England was a 1-point underdog in their own building, and now you're looking at the Dallas Cowboys, a number on the move. Cowboys out to -4 at FanDuel Sportsbook. Of course, the Cowboys team really taking the league by storm, not necessarily because of what they're doing on the offensive side, but Dan Quinn getting this defense to be shaped up, so much so that we now see Trevon Diggs listed at 15-1 to be the defensive player of the year.
Dallas is playing good football right now. There's no doubt about that. The ground game, the offensive line, all coming together. Dak Prescott and the receiver group are able to hit some explosives. It's a very balanced offense. There's a lot of guys contributing. There's a lot of talent on that side of the ball, and the defense has made some improvements. There's no doubt about that. There's a plan from Dan Quinn, and the guys are executing it, and a huge upgrade. When that's the funny part of saying that, is a huge upgrade with Dan Quinn from last year's defensive coordinator in Nolan. And so Dallas is playing great football right now, and obviously there's some question marks about New England. Struggled again last week. Obviously the pro side was the Texans. That's why that game went from 8.5, 9 down to almost like 7.2 at close. But there are some issues in New England. You'll wonder, again, where the talent is outside for Mac Jones to throw to. Defensively, I think we probably overestimated what they were when you look at the opponents the first couple of weeks. And so the secondary has some issues. You're not quite getting after the quarterback at the rate you thought you would. And so it's really, you're looking at a New England team that we're just having questions about at this point. There really hasn't been anything great from that team and Bill Belichick since Tom Brady left. And so you're just asking yourself, is this a middling team at best? And if it's a middling team, you can understand why a Dallas team can't technically be almost a pick on the road here. Now, we may get to a point where I don't know where this stops, but we're at 4 this morning, and
we're even some 4.5. There are even some 4.5.
Let's see where this goes.
Even some 4.5.
Let's just see where this goes. I certainly wouldn't be plowing through the window with a Dallas ticket in your hand at 4.5. Now.
I'm just thinking about this out loud and trying to put in perspective. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers closed 9-point favorites week one against the Cowboys. Tampa closed 6.5 at New England about 7 days ago. And here we are with Dallas, a 4.5-point road favorite. Just some things to think about as you mull over some of the card for next week. And then last but not least, we know this is largely or entirely because of injury moves. Seattle went from a 3-point road favorite with Russell Wilson expected to be in the fold to now finding themselves a 4.5-point underdog at Heinz Field Sunday Night Football for the Geno Smith experience.
No love for Geno. I mean,
he looked good slinging it against the prevent. He looked good slinging against the prevent.
98-yard drive trying to stick it up Artukas there.
he tried his best.
There was at one point in Geno's life, he was being discussed for a Heisman. It was a very brief moment, but that's who's going to be under center for Seattle here on the road. Extra time to prepare. Pittsburgh as a favorite certainly would make you a little bit nervous with how their offense is operating. You mentioned Juju Smith is out for this. The look ahead was Seattle -3. We're now out to Pittsburgh -5. We're going to find out what Russell Wilson means to this organization in games like this. Now, getting an 8-point move, that's a large one. And I think we've had these debates where guys like Aaron Rodgers, Todd, in the past have been out and we've seen odds makers say, he's only worth 6, he's only worth 7. And then finally, like after 3 weeks, like, oh shit, the downgrade might've been like 11 points. I don't know if that's where we're at with this version of Russell Wilson, who's, I believe, almost 34 years old, and how he's been playing recently. I don't know if it's an 8-point move. And I think Geno Smith is probably a little bit better than the options that a Green Bay Packers had behind Aaron Rodgers in those, you know, 10, 11 point adjustments in you know, a couple years ago.
How dare you talk poorly about Brett Hundley, who was promoted to the active roster, I believe, for the Indianapolis Colts going into their game against the Ravens tonight.
Yes, he was. So this will be interesting to navigate. I need to do much more work on this game before having even like a true thought worth of value here.
Lest us not ignore, Geno Smith returns to the scene of the crime a stone's throw from where he achieved his best at college football, as you mentioned, a potential Heisman candidate at West Virginia just across the Pennsylvania border. But plenty of things to think about, adjustments, of course, injuries aplenty, as we always know in the National Football League. But on to tonight, Payne. The final game of Week 5 sees the Indianapolis Colts taking their show on the road to take on the Baltimore Ravens. And you're looking at Baltimore, a touchdown favorite at FanDuel Sportsbook. This total sits at 46.5. We know it's kind of bounced all over throughout the course of the week, getting as high as 48. When you look at these two teams, the Colts have been a dog in every single game this season. Why is that note incredible? They weren't an underdog in a single game at all last year during the regular season up until they went to Buffalo in the playoffs and nearly pulled off the upset against Josh Allen and company. The Ravens, they enter tonight with a little bit of history on the line. 43 games with 100-plus rushing yards after their quote-unquote Bush League move from Vic Fangio last week against the Denver Broncos. It'd be interesting to watch. But when you begin to break this one down, what are some of the key matchups that you're looking for?
I think when you look at the Colts offense against the Ravens defense, it's going to be pretty basic, but it's how Carson Wentz reacts to pressure and that mix of him holding on to the ball versus the blitz is something that's going to be quite interesting. And I don't know what Frank Reich's approach will be tonight, but I think it's got to be to get the ball out of Carson Wentz's hands just a little bit quicker. Right now, he's in the top third of NFL quarterbacks in time to throw because he's just holding on to the ball. He's always held on to the ball at some of the highest rates among quarterbacks. And you look this year, that's part of the reason he's been pressured on a league-high 47% of dropbacks. Now, it's not all Wentz, right? The Colts' offensive line has really been a disaster, and that's putting it nicely. They're 25th in pass block win rate. And Indy's kind of going through this transition, and I love Chris Ballard, but, you know, there's kind of a void of talent along that offensive line compared to what we've seen the last few seasons. They're finding out that life without Anthony Costanzo isn't fun, and Eric Fisher hasn't really been good, and that's putting it kindly. I know he's working his way back from the Achilles tear, but just has not been good. Right tackle Braden Smith is out again tonight. You have your all-world guard, Quentin Nelson, on IR. And now you have Wink Martindale's defense. And they're top five in blitz rate. They're top three in pressure rate. So that's going to be an interesting thing to monitor. Now, Carson Wentz hasn't been terrible. I would say he's been average to slightly below average through 4 weeks, but he's not taking many chances. Done a good job limiting mistakes. Let's give him credit for that. Not a single turnover-worthy throw all season. And he's handled pressure relatively well. But if a defense is going to blitz you all night like the Ravens probably will here, you have to make them pay. You have to be willing, as we say all the time, attack the attacker and make Baltimore pay. And Wentz really hasn't had that mindset in a long time to push the ball downfield. And so I'm not sure he's going to do that. You would think you got to put the ball in Michael Pittman's hands. And he's getting a ton of targets right now. Not a ton of production when you measure those targets against performance and production for Pittman. Jonathan Taylor has got to get back on track a little bit here. He's been decent the last few weeks with good matchups. I don't know how Frank Reich is going to deploy him. He had a ton of catches in week one. That was kind of fluky. I think maybe you want to use him a little bit in the screen game tonight on early downs if you're going to get those Wink Martindale blitzes because he's not the perceived pass catcher and it is first down where everyone's going to think you're running it. Let's see if they operate a couple screens there on early downs and kind of disguise those as runs. But I also think Frank Reich needs to run the ball a little bit differently tonight just looking at some of those metrics. Indy, 66% of their runs are over the guard and center. That's the third highest rate in the league. Baltimore, fourth best defending inside runs when you look at adjusted line yards. The other thing, if the Colts are going to stay in this game, Todd, before I kick it back to you, is the red zone. It's obvious, right? They can't settle for field goals. You need touchdowns. It's like, oh, yes, I get that. But you look at how they've
it's analytics. Analytics for you. Touchdowns are better than field goals.
Seven better than three. Yes. Well, yes, it is. Hey, it is.
You know, we shouldn't say seven, though, yesterday, Payne. It should be six is better than three because the seventh is no longer a formality.
Yes, that is right. That is right. So, you know, the Colts have had some of these red zone woes. They're 30th in touchdown percentage, and even worse, Indy's been getting the ball down there. They lead the league in plays run from inside the five-yard line. Yet only 11% of their red zone plays have gone for touchdowns. That's the league's lowest rate. So you would think that there's some type of positive regression there if they're able to get down in the red area inside the 10. But getting down there could be a little bit more difficult than I think most might think here. And I just, you need Carson Wentz to be a little bit more aggressive tonight. And you're on the road. You're a dog of like 7.2. You need to have a little bit higher variance game plan. The check down Charlie stuff might not work here. And I think you want to run some disguised stuff where on early downs, again, let's get Jonathan Taylor going in the screen game when Wink is sending all out blitzes. And I think that might be the approach to maybe hit some chunk plays that the offense is desperately in need of right now.
I actually believe, Payne, you talk about the Colts running so many plays inside the opponent's five. 76.7% of those plays were run against the Los Angeles Rams in week two, and
is that true? Is that just a number?
No. I was just
came up with out of thin air.
Nah, I feel like I watched it, and that's what I'm going to go with because
that feels right.
Yeah,
feels
it makes sense.
Of those 76% of passes, like 49 of them, now that we're just throwing out numbers, are like left-handed from Carson Wentz as well.
The left-handed shuttle pass is the most efficient pass that any quarterback can can throw inside that 5-yard line. So I want that to be written for all those young high school quarterbacks out there who want to emulate Carson Wentz and some of his piss poor decision making when it comes to crunch time. I will say one thing about this Ravens defense as well. You know, some of the beat writers and folks a lot closer to the organization have really had strong praise for guys like Anthony Averett, who's filled in admirably for Marcus Peters. I know Peters has been one of the more polarizing defensive backs, I think, to a certain extent, getting by largely on reputation, but was always known as a gambler. Averett has stepped in, done a great job there, and when you look at what safety Chuck Clark has done, he's been commended as well by the Ravens coaching staff for his leadership, especially the role calling plays with the green dot. So interesting to see Baltimore really solidifying that pass grouping, and we'll see if it continues to get better today. When we look at the other side of the ball, we know how the Baltimore Ravens elect to try and move the football. They've run the ball 49% of the time, a fourth highest run rate in the league, 5.2 yards per carry, top three. But the one thing we've seen with Lamar Jackson is now an increased desire to throw the deep ball. Greg Roman talked about that, and it wasn't just lip service this offseason. Lamar leads the NFL with 11.6 air yards per attempt and more than 14 yards per completion. Was able to get his second career 300-yard passing game last week. And when you look at his completed air yards, he ranks sixth best in the National Football League now. When you talk about this Baltimore Ravens offense, we knew it was a ground-and-pound mentality. They've gone with the veteran by committee with Devontae Freeman and Latavius Murray taking over. What, in your opinion, is the best way to go about attacking this Colts stop unit?
Well, I think we're going to see Lamar throwing it a little bit more tonight as well, because in addition to Wentz and the Colts offense not having much pop and the Colts operating at the slowest neutral situation pace in the NFL, why pro bettors went under 48 in this game is because of how the Colts have defended the run and how they've defended Baltimore in previous meetings. Right now, the Colts are fifth in defensive rush efficiency, and Indy has some familiarity. If you go back to week 9 last year, they played each other in Indy. Colts held Lamar Jackson to 2.9 a carry, didn't allow him to have a single explosive run or any of his teammates to have an explosive run. And now you have this Ravens offensive line that's beat up, banged up, injured, however you want to slice it. Ronnie Stanley's out. Tyree Phillips has been out. Villanueva is highly questionable for tonight as well. So Lamar is going to have to be an efficient passer, to your point. We saw an offense even against Denver that wasn't really great down to down. It's why they were struggling to reach that 100 rush yard metric there. But there was a lot of over-the-top stuff. And that is one element of Lamar's game that's improved. He is fourth in completion percentage above expectation, 12th in EPA per dropback. And if you're getting those passing numbers from Lamar while he's also the most efficient running quarterback, then you really have something under center, you know? And you look at this matchup, I'm not really sure the Colts will be able to take advantage of Baltimore's issues along the O-line. So that makes even more sense, because if Lamar's back there, we know obviously he's mobile, but Indy hasn't been able to get pressure, 31st in pressure rate. So Lamar could be sitting back there pretty clean, just tapping the ball, navigating space and figuring out who's open. And that lack of pressure from Indy has been partly why. I mean, you had Xavier Rhodes missed the first couple games, and you have Rocky Sin, who's also out again tonight. But Indy hasn't been able to stop the pass. 25th in defensive pass efficiency, 26th in explosive pass defense, which again is something Todd outlined and something to really pay attention to tonight. It's been a real issue for the Colts defense. So there is this advantage for Lamar through the air. He is attempting a career high 31 passes per game. We also mentioned Hollywood Brown in the offseason and how he needs to actually step up and become a true number one receiver. He hadn't been that in the past. Right now, just such a pleasant surprise. His game's gone to another level. Did have some crucial drops in that Lions game, but aside from that, he's been nails. He's eighth most valuable receiver right now, nearly 27% better than an average receiver. It's possible we see the debut of Rashad Bateman as well. That'd be a nice weapon to have against a really poor Colts secondary. I'm trying to be really nice here, Todd. When I look at this game, we made it 7.8, so there's not a ton of value. And I'm looking at the screen right now. Buckeye did flicker to 7.5. Pinnacle is at 7.5. All the sharpest shops were dealing 7.5. Buckeye was the first one to actually get a taste of Colts money. And so it tells me that it will sound weird, but to this point, both the public and the pros, although not a ton of pro money, some pro money at 6.5, some maybe grazing lightly at 7, have had an appetite for Baltimore. I just haven't seen the snap of like, hey, we want the Colts at 7.5. That's our buy price. We just haven't really seen that to this point. Under is the sharpest thing in this game. And I love our loyal listeners very much, but because we were recording this podcast last Monday, we ended up missing on the under 48. We were actually going to wait until after I was done with the podcast, and about 5 minutes before we concluded the podcast, in came the under wave at 48, and it didn't stop there. There's a second wave at 47. Now, I wouldn't say go ram and jam here at 46, because 48 and 47 do have relevance. 47 is the third largest key number for totals, but you're kind of in combination here of the 47 and the 48 that were missed. They fall, those two numbers, about 6.5% of the time. So there's a ton of value lost. This could clearly still cash, but chasing steam, probably not the best recipe at this point in time.
No, it's not the best recipe for this game or any other. Let that be a PSA for all of you, our loyal listeners. That pain couldn't have been more clear about when you try and identify opportunity and taking those modest edges that we look for in the betting market. Oftentimes, discretion is the better part of valor. You'll hear me say that often, and it can mean passing on a game rather than putting up 11 to win 10 will put you in a better long-term spot than chasing a number that no longer exists. All right, my good man, broken down the final game of NFL Week 5. We get a 48-hour hiatus from one another before we reconvene on Wednesday with a little college football talk. Anything else you wanted to get off your chest? Did you want to offer up any thoughts on what we saw unfold at T-Mobile Arena on Saturday night between Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury?
We have exceeded an hour, so we've gone past the threshold of trying to get this out quicker and trying to get this out to our audience a little faster. That fight was pretty good. It's one of the better heavyweight fights I've seen in a long time. And Deontay Wilder is what he is. He's kind of a one-trick pony that refuses to jab. He's all power. And for a guy that looks like he's in great physical shape, he has a tendency to gas. The legs, a little wobbly, it seems like, at all times. And Tyson Fury came out and is basically like, after the last fight, I was in the pub for months just drinking. And he was, I think, 30 pounds heavier, roughly, give or take, than the second matchup that they fought in. And Tyson Fury still beat him. So, not much to take from that other than it was a great fight to watch and it was really entertaining.
Definitely brought some entertainment value amid a busy football weekend for sure. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You, of course, can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at BetTheBoardPod. FanDuel.com. Use the promo code BetTheBoard. Take advantage of those generous sign-up bonuses for all of your upcoming investments. Want to wish everyone the best of luck with all their selections on Monday Night Football, and we'll be back with you on Wednesday. Hopefully, in the meantime, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.